dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man whose intelligence I've come to admire enormously over the years is Dr. Dan Gray. He is the vice president of the Lexington Institute. He has served in a number of official capacities as well, including as the director of the Office of Strategic Competitiveness in the Office of the Secretary of Defense. He is the author with the former Secretary of the Air Force of an Atlantic Council paper on fifth-generation aircraft, and it's a sort of introduction to a topic we'll be discussing with him here, namely, how do we modernize our forces to deal with the existing and emerging threats of our time. Dan Gray, it's so good to have you back. Welcome. It's been too long.
Thank you. It's always my pleasure.
I wanted to start, Dan, with something we've been discussing a bit on the program, but get your take on it as well. That is the degree to which we've seen in recent days an immense nuclear simulation of an attack against the United States by Russia, involving very large numbers of nuclear forces and the clear dedication of Vladimir Putin personally to brandishing such weapons as threats against us, at best and at worst, perhaps planning to use them. Talk, if you would, about this both in the context of what we've seen and what it says about our own deterrent to such attack.
Well, this is the largest Russian strategic nuclear exercise in decades. It actually, in some respects, exceeds almost anything we've seen during the latter stages of the Cold War. And in particular, what it involves is not only a demonstration of a systematic, massive attack on the United States, sort of the practice drill for this, and on targets around the world, but also demonstrated sort of all the new toys that the Putin administration has been producing. Land-based nuclear weapons, submarine-launched weapons, air-launched weapons, some of the theater weapons. It was sort of a roadshow of all the new goodies, and they've been modernizing across the board, and we saw it all on display in this major exercise.
Yeah, toys and goodies, of course, is a euphemism for the most deadly of weapons, and as you say, they have now been demonstrated to varying degrees in the use of them against this country. And Dan, again, this brings to the fore the question of, have we adequately maintained our own inventory of nuclear weaponry? Specifically, is it adequate to deter this sort of threat from Russia, to say nothing of what the Chinese have been beavering away at, much of it hidden in underground tunnels, some 3,000 miles of them, and hardened caves in which their submarine forces are deployed or are stationed?
To deter, our nuclear forces must be reliable, survivable, and capable. And on all three counts, we have let our capabilities erode. We have now aging Minutemen land-based missiles that have gone through two cycles of upgrades, but are still essentially basically a 1960s missile. We have
50 years old.
We have a submarine fleet based on the Ohio-class SSBN, nuclear ballistic missile submarine, that are reaching the end of their life, and we're in a tearing hurry to build the new Columbia-class. And we have aging and limited numbers of them, really, of strategic bombers. And in fact, very few that can actually penetrate to targets. And penetration is important because if you want that credibility, you need to be able to tell the Russians that we have weapons that no matter what they do can reach the most sensitive Russian strategic targets, military, political, even industrial, and ensure that they are destroyed. And even our bomber force has essentially eroded over time while the Russians have built up a very formidable air defense capability.
Indeed. So that is a whole other topic for conversation. And Dan, we need to get you back for a long visit on all of this. But what they've done in terms of strategic defense, air defenses, missile defenses, civil defenses, leadership defenses is a whole nother component of their posture that is, I'm concerned, very much out of alignment with our ability to deter it. Dan, let me ask you about this in the context of something that you've been thinking hard about and working on at the Lexington Institute. In fact, you've got a recent paper in terms of defense leaders' modernization plans requiring rethinking about how it partners with industry. What should we, in the very briefest of form for this purpose, if you would, what should we be doing to shorten the time that it takes us to, for example, modernize our nuclear deterrent, to say nothing of our larger conventional forces as well?
In particular, we need to reduce the kind of requirements, demands we put on those programs. 100 different requirements. It has to be able to work in the hottest of weather, the coldest of weather, on Thursdays, when the power is, I mean, you sort of go down this list.
Leap tall buildings in a single bound.
Single bound. That's right. And once you get past a basic set, you know, it's got to do its job. It's got to be reliable. It's got to go bang when you want it to go bang. And, you know, it's got to be accurate. We ought to be limiting what we demand out of those systems and thinking about replacing them more frequently rather than having 50-year-old ballistic missiles. We got to say, okay, this next one isn't gold-plated, but it's better than the one we had before. And being newer, it's easier to modernize or it's easier to maintain and just keep churning that. We used to do that in the 50s, 60s, really into the 80s. And then for the last 25, 30 years, we stopped doing that. We now replace things once on a generation or worse basis. And as a result, it's very slow, very expensive, and not timely.
Dan, you're thinking about the industrial base is always one of the things that I value so much. And again, a subject for a much more in-depth conversation shortly. But to what extent does the fact that we deliberately downsized the industrial capabilities of this country that historically supported our defense needs, the lack of competition, the lack of robustness that would enable that kind of more rapid modernization program. I mean, is that a component in this problem, or is that simply a product of the other problem?
No, I think you're exactly right. It is its own problem, because what we end up doing is foolishly look to save money in times of peace. To be efficient is the word, rather than effective. And efficiency sort of says, if I'm only going to buy a small number and do that rarely, I don't need a large, constantly churning industrial base. I'm paying essentially for standby capability. And as a result, if you don't do that, when you need effectiveness, when you need competition, when you need to produce large numbers of aircraft or tanks or nuclear forces rapidly, you don't have that industrial base. You don't have the trained design teams that we're now going to be trying to redesign weapons or build new kinds of weapons, ballistic missiles. There's barely anybody still in industry who remembers the last time we designed and built it.
It's the difference between standing by and atrophying, and it seems as though we've had an awful lot of the latter. Dan, thank you for the work you do at the Lexington Institute and for joining us from time to time. Keep up that good work.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. It is my pleasure to say, joined by Chris Iacovella, a man I've gotten to know recently through the work that he has been doing at the American Securities Association. He is, among other things, the president of that association and a man with deep experience in the financial markets, both from the financial piece of that business, as well as the legal. He's a trained attorney. And from a policy perspective, honed by his experiences working for the Commodity Futures Trading Commission in the regulatory space and in the oversight space on Capitol Hill as a senior advisor to the Financial Services Committee. Chris is the author of a brand new piece that ran on the 19th of October in Real Clear Politics entitled, Why Are American Investors Funding Chinese Fraud? A pregnant question that we've been trying to get our hands around here for some time. Chris Iacovella, it's terrific to have you with us. Thank you for the work you've been doing to expose this bizarre situation, and I look forward to exploring it with you.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Frank. It's a real pleasure.
Chris, before we get into the article, I just wanted to also commend you and our listeners, for that matter, to the piece that you contributed very handsomely in the Committee on the Present Danger China Threat Briefing in September, where we drilled down on some of these issues, specifically with regard to the idea that American investors who happen to work for the federal government, either in the civilian or military side, past as well as present, could be obliged to be funding some of these fraudulent Chinese companies. So we're going to talk a little bit about that as well. But if you would, just give us an overview of what's been happening with respect to the so-called passive investment vehicles like the Morgan Stanley Capital International Index with regard to Chinese companies.
Well, Frank, I think what we've found through some research and through some investigation here is that there's a passive index loophole, which is being taken advantage of by Wall Street's ETF issuers and the index providers such as MSCI, as you just described. And what they're doing is taking advantage of this loophole to get around the Security and Exchange Commission's company-specific audit and disclosure requirements in order to get Chinese companies that are either fraudulent, that are on the sanctions list, or that are on the do not do business list into an index so that American dollars can be funneled out of this country and into China.
And specifically to enable these companies, and some of them may not be on any list at the moment, but they should be because of what they're doing, right?
That's right. But the fact is that there are a number of them that make these lists. And to my eye, having somebody on the do not do business list, meaning that United States companies, United States government cannot do business with these companies, but yet at the same time, American money and investor dollars can be funded to them, makes absolutely no sense. And it's very disturbing.
Yeah. And when you say American investors, not a small percentage of those investors are being put in jeopardy because their retirement funds are being invested in these companies. And in your piece at Real Clear Politics, you talked about Kang Mei Pharmaceutical as an example of how this can go seriously wrong. Talk about that, Chris Iacovella, if you would, and whether it's possible that there may be other Kang Mei fiascos in store.
Yes, I mean, Kang Mei is the perfect example, Frank. It is a situation where $4.4 billion of company money went, quote unquote, missing. Missing.
I'm sorry, you said $4.4 billion, as in boy, oh boy, billion dollars?
That's exactly right. Missing. And the Chinese government, after this money went missing, directed the Chinese security regulator to look into how this could possibly happen. And surprisingly enough, the Chinese security regulator actually came back with a pretty harsh description of what happened. And they said that it was a malicious and intentional cheating of investors. And that question, how in the world can a company like this get into an index that's sold to American investors? And not only that, after this type of issue happens where fraud, true fraud, $4.4 billion worth of it, fraud happens, this company's still in the indexes. So our view is that these companies are controlled by the Chinese Communist Party. And whenever that party decides that the useful life of the company is over, or decides that it needs a cash injection to fund some other company or some weapon system or surveillance technology somewhere else, then it will take that money. And U.S. investors will have no legal recourse as companies are siphoned clean out of all their funds. And the MSCI and the ETF issuers do nothing about it because they want to have access to the Chinese market. In the case of the MSCI index, the Chinese government has put pressure on them to expand the amount of money that goes into Chinese companies from now until the next 5 years. And that, to us, is very concerning, which is why we're ringing the bell here, because we want American investors to know that your money can disappear overnight. This is very much like the frauds that we saw during the financial crisis that were based on securities that were based on and filled with fraudulent mortgages.
Yeah, well, and Enron comes to mind as another example, of course, too. So this is outrageous on so many different levels, Chris Iacovella, and I really want to salute you and the American Securities Association for the alarm that you are sounding, notably in this piece at Real Clear Politics. But just to recap, the SEC is not requiring the law that American companies must adhere to with respect to transparency and accountability, Sarbanes-Oxley and Dodd-Frank among them. And there's a competitive advantage to the Chinese, quite apart from the fact that they're getting access to our capital markets when they wouldn't otherwise be allowed to. Talk about what it means for the companies in this country that have to actually meet those transparency and accountability standards and the costs associated therewith.
I mean, Frank, that's a terrific point that you're bringing up, because what we're talking about are small businesses here in America that have to compete for capital on a daily basis. And now you have these companies who, if they want to become public, they incur an average annual compliance cost of $1.5 million a year. Now, if you're a Chinese company and you get to use this loophole, you don't have that cost. That's $1.5 million a year that goes somewhere else. In the United States, our companies are put at a disadvantage. And all what we've been saying and others for a long period of time is, how is it possible that Chinese companies are allowed to get around just basic minimum regulatory scrutiny, but U.S. companies can't do the same?
Yeah, it's egregiously unfair to our own businesses, as you say, not only the companies that are in the marketplace, but also those who are seeking investment dollars. And it's doubly outrageous because, as you've also indicated, Chris Iacovella, some of these funds, at least, are going into companies that you can't do business with, and yet you can invest in them. And the business they're in ranges from imposing horrific repressive measures on Chinese citizens and now increasingly others as this kind of social credit score technology is being exported, and building South China Sea islands that are fortified for the purposes of, locking us out of those waters, or that, for example, are building aircraft carriers and other weapon systems with which to kill Americans. I mean, this is insane. And I just want to spend the last minute or two we have with you, Chris Iacovella, talking about further injury that is in prospect in this regard if, as now seems to be, imminent, there will be American federal government employees, both civilian and military, past, like my case, for example, and present, who will be tasked or effectively compelled to invest in these kinds of Chinese companies. What on earth is going on with the thrift savings plan in this regard?
Well, the thrift savings plan, it's eminent wisdom that they are going to force or compel, as you use, that's a much better term, American government employees to invest only one offering if they want to get access to international equity exposure. And that offering includes these exact Chinese companies that you described who are in the business of weapon systems, surveillance systems, and so forth. And we also have been very supportive of the committee and others trying to push back on the TSP so that they come to their senses and take this index with Chinese companies in it out of the offering to our service members and our federal employees all over this country who don't want to participate in the funding of the communist regime.
Well, where does this stand right now, Chris? You've written your piece as kind of a shot across the bow. Is there a chance that they will reverse that decision as they stand now?
We're hopeful that they will. This is, another government bureaucracy that has to go through its processes. And we're hopeful that during its evaluation, reevaluation of this poor decision, that they will reverse this. And to the extent that they do not, we expect pressure to come in from Congress and from various parts of the administration, especially as folks become more and more aware of what's going on here.
Yeah. Thank you for calling it out and for the work that you do at the American Securities Association. Chris Iacovella, how can people find out more about your work?
Well, they can go to americansecurities.org and follow us. We're also at AmerSecurities on Twitter. And we'd love to have as many folks follow us as possible, and we really appreciate it.
Amen. God bless you. Keep up the good work. Come back to us again very soon, Chris, if you would.
Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're joined by a senior fellow at the Center for Security Policy, our duty expert on economic warfare, a subject whose practice he has been studying and chronicling and warning about for years, notably in his two best-selling books, Secret Weapon and Game Plan, and of course on his terrific Blaze TV television program, Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman. He is, of course, Kevin Freeman. We're delighted to have him back. Welcome, Kevin. Good to talk with you.
Thank you, Frank. Great to be here.
I wanted to pick up where we left off with Chris Iacovella a moment ago, Kevin, specifically on this issue of the Thrift Savings Plan, representing millions of past and present U.S. government employees, including military personnel, and having them essentially forced to invest their retirement funds in companies that include some very problematic Chinese ones. What's going on with that as you see it, and how might we, reckon with the need to counter it in light of the apparent desire of the people who brought us this decision in the first place, the Federal Retirement Thrift Investment Board's decision to proceed in this direction in 2020.
Well, this is the problem, Frank, with international index funds. You get what you get, and you don't throw a fit. Is kind of the phrase. When you buy an index fund, you get whatever's in the index fund, and the Chinese have been masterful at maneuvering through these funds to capture a large share and an increasingly large share of the dollars that are put into international funds. It's all well and good that you say, hey, look, I want to have international diversification. That's a great idea. I was a proponent of that when I was at the Templeton Funds. I support that idea entirely. It's another thing, however, when you're telling a serviceman or you're telling a veteran or you're telling a patriotic government employee or retiree, you have to put, if you want international diversification, you have to put it where we say, and that includes communist China and these companies that have potentially no accounting to U.S. standards, that may be doing things that are completely contrary to what we want to see accomplished. They may be really harming their own citizens. They may be bad actors in the world. They may be spying on us, or they might be producing weapons that would be used against us. So that's a serious problem.
In a way, this makes the controversy over the NBA pale by comparison, doesn't it? We're really talking about enabling the threat against our country with our retirement funds. And quite apart from the TSP, that's happening right now with other institutional investors, isn't it?
Of course it is. And the Chinese have been masterful at issuing initial public offerings on our exchanges or buying up shell companies so that they could get access to U.S. capital markets. There are a large number of listed Chinese companies now, today, that we don't know exactly what they're doing. We have no transparency in the accounting. And just to illustrate the point, one thing that you and I spoke out on 5 years ago as Alibaba, the largest initial public offering. They took $25 billion of American capital, and who knows exactly how they're using it, because we have no transparency. We can't really look at their accounting on U.S. accounting standards, and we don't really even own the actual Chinese shares. We own shares in the Cayman Islands Corporation. They're talking about multiplying that by a factor of 10, 20, 50, whatever, by getting into this index and then using the retirement savings of our patriotic employees. That's just crazy.
It is crazy. And Kevin, just to reprise something that Chris is very worked up about, and I assume you are too, as a chartered financial analyst, as well as a serious practitioner in the economic warfare space, is that the Chinese companies are, as you've said, not meeting up to the disclosure requirements of American companies. So not only don't we know what their actual status is, in one case that Chris has talked about, pharmaceutical firm, they simply disappeared, $4.4 billion. Talk just quickly, if you would, about the material risk piece of this and what it means to investors, especially, as you've said, government employees and military personnel.
Well, as an investment advisor, if you were investing your client funds in fake sham companies and you weren't doing the due diligence necessary, you'd be held responsible for that. Here's a case where you can't do the due diligence necessary. It's considered a state secret or national secret, their accounting. So we can't actually look in the companies. Now, I've been in China looking at companies as a financial analyst with Dr. Mark Mobius, who was one of the great emerging market investors of all time. And you'd look at the companies, they didn't give you the data that you have to have here in the United States that you're forced by law to report. How we could exempt those companies from meeting U.S. reporting standards doesn't make sense to me. This is material risk, and we're putting clients and real dollars at risk.
And to make matters worse, those real dollars are being employed in ways that are going to harm our country and its interests. This is just outrageous on so many different levels. Kevin, we appreciate the work you do on this, among other places, at Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman. And I hope that we will have a chance to prevent this deal from going down with the thrift savings plan, though it seems as though there may be an intention on the part of this oversight board that they'll just keep running out the clock until suddenly it's too late and they can't do anything about it. They're now mirroring the so-called Morgan Stanley Capital International Index prescriptions. Kevin, I do want to turn to another topic that's been a hardy perennial of our conversations for a long time, and that is one of the other Chinese economic warfare lines of attack is the effort to replace our currency with their own, or at the very least, simply take it out as a reserve currency of the world. I just want to get your latest thinking on this. There's a report that an IMF official, International Monetary Fund official, has recently described the yuan, or the renminbi as it's called, the Chinese currency, as, quote, the second most important currency in the world, unquote. Is that so? And if it's not, is it likely to be anytime soon? And what, again, are the implications if the Chinese are able to create at least this illusion that their currency is a reliable alternative to the U.S. dollar?
Well, there's a couple of points to take from this. One of, you know, it was in China Daily, and so this is the Chinese perspective. Keep in mind that the quote comes from the International Monetary Fund, and it shows you the success that China has had of an influence operation with critical leaders around the world. And they have done that very, very intelligently and successfully. What they've done is they've put in the mind of a lot of American leadership, a lot of corporations and business leaders and so forth, plus the International Monetary Fund, the United Nations, and other places. They've bought this influence so that it's assumed that China will naturally take the top economic spot in the world. Now, the facts tell otherwise, at least in the case of the use of the renminbi or the yuan as a reserve currency. It is down the list, according to SWIFT, U.S. dollar, euro, and all the way down, it is barely above the Hong Kong dollar. It is number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 8th place in the world with a 1.22% share versus 32% for the euro. Now, before we say, oh, well, they're just blowing smoke, we have to keep in mind that that is the SWIFT transaction system, and the Chinese have built an alternative to the SWIFT transaction system where they will be pushing a lot of international trade to go through their currency. SWIFT is a Western-dominated system and one that we've used in the past successfully to close down on rogue regimes or drug cartels and so forth by cutting them off from doing that trade. So the Chinese have built, with the Russian support and others, an alternative system, and they will be pushing, pushing their currency trade through their system rather than Swiss system. So this is a story that is not yet played out. But at the moment, that was a very overreaching statement, to say the least. They're about 1.22% of international trade with their currency.
But their ambition is clear. And as you say, Kevin, their alternative to the Swiss system is just one of the alternative institutions that they have been putting into place, which could enable them over time, at the very least, to swing into some other basket of currencies or something for the purpose of replacing the dollar as the reserve currency of the world. And I know we don't need to go over it again with you, though it's important for all of us to understand that would be very bad for us, including most especially how we manage our immense debt if we can't adjust or otherwise manage it with, you know, printing money, for one thing. Let me ask you about one other thing, Kevin. You follow closely what the Chinese are saying in terms of their statistics. They've acknowledged, I gather, that they didn't even make the 6% growth in GDP that they have long considered to be, you know, sort of de minimis in terms of what they must perform at. Do we have reason to believe confident in any of their numbers, Kevin, whether it's 5% or any other for that matter?
Well, at 6%, maybe 0%. And if they're below 6%, they may be negative. They run a great game of influence operations and trying to create perceptions around the inevitability of the Chinese economy. But it's important to realize this is not a game to them. This is warfare. And in fact, whether it is entering our markets or whether it is manipulating currencies, all of that we view it as a marketplace. China views it as a battle space, and they're fighting a war right there.
They are indeed, and unfortunately, they're making considerable headway, at least in terms of manipulating our perceptions of them, as you say. Kevin Friedman, this is what we rely on you so much to help us both reckon with and counter, and we appreciate your time each week, as well as what you do at outlets like Economic War Room, and you can find out how you can subscribe at economicwarroom.com. Kevin, come back to us next week if you would. In the meantime, God bless you. Next up, we'll speak with Rahim Kassam right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, joined by one of my favorite people. He is Rahim Kassam. He has been, among other things, a very influential figure on both sides of the pond, notably through his work with Nigel Farage on Brexit at a critical moment, and in this country with several different organizations and capacities, notably Breitbart back in the day. He is today with the American Principles Project, and the author of several critically important books, including No-Go Zones, How Sharia Law is Coming to a Neighborhood Near You, and Enoch Was Right, Rivers of Blood, 50 Years On. Rahim, it is so good to have you with us. Welcome back. It's been far too long.
It has been far too long. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's urgent now because I desperately need your help in making sense of what is going on with respect to Brexit at the moment under the not-so-tender mercies of Boris Johnson on the one hand and the British Parliament and courts and, well, the establishment, shall we say, in the UK on the other.
Well, let me tell you, you're not the only one who needs my help in that regard. I think before, you'll remember that we had this dreadful prime minister beforehand. In fact, we haven't had a good one since Thatcher. But Theresa May led us down this path, having negotiated a terrible deal with the European Union 3 years after Britain voted in majority in our greatest democratic exercise in our country's history. And it was rejected time and time and time again. This led Theresa May to resign. She had no other choice. She had no path forward. And the Conservative Party set upon a path in the UK to crown Boris Johnson as their new prime minister. Now, Boris was a Brexiteer, a reluctant one at first, but he was a Brexiteer. So that made a change from Theresa May. And so everybody got their hopes up. This is our guy. He's going to do it. He's eccentric. He knows what he's talking about. He's going to push this right on through.
And he said he would. He said he would. And he said that even if we don't get a deal, it'll be done at the end of this month.
He said he would rather be dead in a ditch than ask for another extension to the Brexit deadline. Well, luckily for Boris Johnson and Boris Johnson's family, he's not dead in a ditch. But he has been forced to go back to the European Union in the last couple of weeks. And I'll explain the process just very briefly. He renegotiated Theresa May's deal, effectively just rehashed it. A couple of wording changes here. He came back to Britain, you know, with his paper in his hand, waving it in the air, saying, you know, deal in our time. But the truth of the matter was it wasn't much of a change from Theresa May's deal.
I thought that it was rather substantial in terms of how the Northern Ireland issue was addressed from what May was willing to do.
It sounds like it, doesn't it? But then if you actually read the deal, which not a lot of people have, if you read the deal, if you read all 64 pages, and if you read the 24 pages of what's also called the political declaration, which goes hand in hand with the withdrawal agreement, it actually is just a change in semantics more than anything else. The deal with the Irish border was that the European Union effectively wanted to keep Northern Ireland, just like the Republic of Ireland to the south, inside the European Customs Union. They said it would be in compliance, therefore, with the Good Friday Agreement, maintain the peace, make sure there's no hard border, and make sure, of course, that Northern Ireland had some kind of relationship still with the United Kingdom, given that it's in the United Kingdom. Boris comes back, and the changes to the deal, what they effectively say is Northern Ireland will be considered part of the UK customs area, but there will still have to be checks and there will still have to be some sort of committee that's effectively staffed and managed by the European Union to make sure that goods going in and out of Northern Ireland are compliant with EU regulations. Well, that doesn't sound like independence to me. That doesn't sound like we're making our own laws, we're making our own trade deals, we're making our own regulations, which was entirely the point of Brexit when it came to trade policy and when it came to the Irish border. So while Boris came back and he declared, you know, we have kept the union together, we have kept Northern Ireland in the customs area, it's really in name only. And that's become a term that's being used in the United Kingdom now. You have your rhinos, we have Brino, Brexit in name only. So I warned in advance that Boris wasn't really the type of guy who could ram this through and get this done. My take was always that we had to have another general election, where I hoped at that point we could get some Brexit party, that's Nigel Farage's party, Brexit party MPs into the Commons to force this through. Lo and behold, once again, Frank, I was right.
Yeah. So the current status of Boris Johnson's new deal, in a manner of speaking, is that it is dead on arrival, has not got any actual political moment to it, and he's going to have to somehow get a general election called. Is that where we stand now?
Well, he's won over a few more Brexiteers, a few more of the hardliners in his own party over this. But there are still people holding out. And of course, the opposition parties, the Liberal Democrats, the Scottish National Party, the Labour Party, are all in opposition. Critically, the Democratic Unionist Party, which the Conservative Party often relies on in what's called a confidence and supply voting agreement in the House of Commons chamber, are also against this because they are a Northern Irish pro-UK Unionist Party, and they see this as driving a wedge between Great Britain and Northern Ireland, correctly identify it as such. So the vote hasn't even come to pass on the withdrawal agreement yet because the Speaker of the House, which is supposed to be a neutral position, is using his position in tandem with some of David Cameron, remember him, with some of David Cameron's former advisors, including Oliver Letwin, who have introduced wrecking amendments to this. And what they've done is Parliament has effectively passed legislation that says there can be no no-deal scenario. There can be no scenario on October the 31st when Britain goes back to the European Union and says, look, we had a deal, we made a deal, we couldn't pass a deal, and therefore we leave with no deal. We go back to World Trade Organization rules that govern our trading relationship. Parliament, in addition to the courts and in addition to the Speaker of the House, have effectively rendered Brexit at this point in time null and void. The only way out of this is to hold a general election. But guess, Frank, who has the power to call a general election? It used to be the Prime Minister. Now it's a majority vote of Parliament.
The majority evidently would very much like to see Boris out, but they don't want to go to the people because they fear, am I right, Rahim, that they will see a new Brexit party emerging from the ashes of the Tories?
Well, not just that, but the Labour Party, which is run by this dreadful anti-Semite Jeremy Corbyn, despite all of the Brexit unraveling over the last couple of years, the Labour Party is still monumentally unpopular. So the Labour Party knows that if they were to vote for a general election, they would likely lose seats both to the Conservative Party and the Brexit Party. So their whole operation right now is just to stall and delay and delay and delay. And that's exactly what they're doing. Parliament doesn't want to vote for to have a general election because Parliament knows that at a general election, the British public are so incensed right now that they would turf all of the anti-Brexiteer people out.
And even if that's not exactly correct, it would change the complexion of the Parliament and perhaps create a different set of circumstances for Brexit. So where do we go from here? If there can be no election without a majority and without an election, there's not going to be any changes. Is the Labour Party going to get their way, Rahim Kassam?
Well, it looks that way for now. Boris Johnson this week has published all the necessary legislation that must be passed in order to achieve Brexit on October the 31st by hook or by crook, whether deal or no deal. And again, the Labour Party, in conjunction with the Speaker of the House, are trying to just delay and force the government to accept a new extension. Now, it's interesting. For an extension to the Brexit deadline, you actually have to have the unanimity of the 26 other European Union member states' leaders. And while Jean-Claude Juncker, who's the head of the European Commission, has said he doesn't want another extension, Angela Merkel has said she does want another extension. And therefore, it looks like we will not be able to avoid another extension, which takes us into late January of next year.
Well, Rahim Kassam, this is mortally depressing for all of us, and you most especially, who have been cheering for Britain to free itself from the European Union, which is, I believe, very much in the interest of the United States as well as the British people. I pray that this will take a turn for the better, and we look forward to visiting with you much more regularly in the future to ensure that we're on top of it. I appreciate you walking us through the arcane developments and sorry saga of what is afoot here. And I had so much more that I wanted to talk with you about, including a very, very concerning piece that you've written about influence operations inside our own country. But that is for another day. I hope very soon. Come back to us. I hope the rest of you will do the same again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.